Okay, good afternoon. Again, I'm Catherine Martin. I'm director for the California Immunization Coalition, not Edgar Endicott or Ken August, as your program says. But I know we are happy to have Ken August. I saw him come in here, and so I might sneak a question in there to him from the podium here. We are a statewide coalition, and we're sort of an umbrella organization for about 18 to 20 local and regional coalitions. If you're familiar with working with coalitions, you know they sort of wax and wane depending on volunteers and funding. And as all of you know, and you're probably experiencing in your own state, our funds are waning quite a bit in California. And so they're struggling quite a bit, but we do what we can to help support them as a statewide coalition. And our goal, our mission, is to achieve full immunization protection for all Californians, but indeed anybody we come across, to protect their health and to prevent serious illness. And mainly what we do in our coalition is about, it kind of falls under the umbrella of also advocacy and education, advocating for immunizations, advocating for funds for immunizations, protecting health programs to get adolescents, adults and children immunized, and educating everybody else, educating our legislators, our thought leaders, our educators, physicians, providers, and the public. We do mainly focus on people like yourselves, physicians, providers, nurses, health educators, and the media, for example. We have resources and connections on our website to the CDC and CDPH and other, like Immunization Action Coalition, all the other great resources. So we don't create a lot of resources ourselves. We push them out to the folks that, like yourselves, who create them. So what I'm going to share with you today is more information about that seventh grade mandate, which turned into be a bigger mandate, the pertussis epidemic, the concurrent pertussis epidemic of 2010, and I think you've probably heard that we continue to have high numbers in California, even though I'm not sure if it's still considered an epidemic, but there's still more, higher numbers than we've seen in the past during the same time period. And then kind of review a lot more about how we've worked to communicate and collaborate on these efforts. In April of last year, I was at an airport checking email, and I got a message, and I can't remember who it was from, but it was about the two deaths that had occurred and the much higher number of cases that we were seeing in California. And it got me so angry because for the last 3 years, our coalition and our team of volunteers at the Capitol, I'm the paid staff and one other person, so we don't have lobbyists or anybody like that. We have people that work with professional associations that work at the Capitol anyway, but also help us get the message out. So angry because we've been working for 3 years, practically since I started the position, on trying to get this seventh grade mandate passed. And we've been telling the legislators and the legislative staff that pertussis is cyclical, we had a big epidemic in 2005, it's going to happen again. And, you know, it just wasn't resonating with them. They weren't seeing it. But now we had their attention. It took an epidemic. I was mad, and this is bad, I'm thinking, but at the same time, it's an opportunity. And I felt like, in a weird way, kind of positive that maybe this is what it had to take to get this done in California. I know other states have done it. We showed them, and I didn't have it up here, but we created this wonderful map showing that everybody but 13 states in the United States have got something approaching a mandate for pertussis prevention. And, you know, they kind of wanted to, but it was all about the money. So I know you can relate to that. Our community, so I'm going to talk about the pertussis epidemic interchangeably with the mandate, because like I said, it all sort of happened all at once there. Our communication goals at this time were to get the mandate passed, but also to get information out to the public, were to educate opinion leaders and legislative staff. A lot of you know if you do any kind of advocacy work, you often don't get a chance to speak with the legislators themselves, but you do have access to their staff quite often, and so that was key. We want to provide information and resources to providers. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Support the media marketing efforts of the immunization branch. I feel so blessed in my work to be able to do what I'm doing as a coalition director and have a lot of flexibility about what I say, but also to get to work with wonderful people in public health and to be able to partner with them and other professional associations and organizations to get out this information. And our other goal is to direct the media and the public to credible and consistent resources. This is a quote from one of our members of the coalition, Dr. Dean Blumberg, who's with us today also. He's a pediatric infectious disease specialist at UC Davis. When we go to the legislature when a bill's being heard, you go before them and you testify, and some people take a long time to say what they want to say, and these policymakers, they listen for a while, but then they tune out. And we were at the I think it was the Appropriations Committee, the biggie, because they were going to decide if it was going to cost anything. And so I think they would get a little weary of hearing some long speeches, and they also had to get to another meeting, so they asked people to keep it short. Well, Dr. Blumberg goes up there and says, vaccine's good, disease is bad. And they're like, and something else about, you know, we've got, you know, support immunizations save lives. And they're like, thank you. They were very appreciative of that, and they got it. You know, less is more. I got up there and said something brief as well, but I kind of gave it to him because, as I said, I'm on this roll of being kind of angry. And I said, you know, we've been coming before you for the last 3 years telling you this is going to happen. It's happening, and you need to pass this legislation now. It's simple as that. You know, it doesn't work for everybody. It turns out that this the chair, and I don't know if it was Dr. Blumberg's and my eloquent little speech, but it ended up that they did help push this through all the way. Going back to those cases, find out where I'm at here. These are the numbers that I've read online through the CDPH website, and it's pretty astonishing. The 9,477 confirmed probable and suspect cases of pertussis through those times, and I think some numbers may still be coming in, or is that just about it for now? Still coming in. I want to share a little bit about how we worked with the media and the media to outreach to the public during this time. If my wonderful colleagues at CDPH were able to come up here and share this with you, we would talk together about how we worked with the immunization program staff and the public affairs staff to help raise awareness about the pertussis epidemic. Kathleen shared, a ton of media. I know whenever there's an epidemic or a big outbreak in your area, you get interest because, again, it's the bad things they often want to share, not the great, you know, yay, we went up 2 points on our immunization rates. They want to share that, but we only got, I think, thanks to a lot to social media, is a ton of hits from national news and a lot of blogs and actually internationally, and I Twitter a lot, so I can tell you a little bit more about that, or tweet a lot. We make up our own. But the CDPH public information officers went beyond focusing on just the news media and reaching out to local health. They reached out to local health departments, their PIOs, the CDC, and other public health partners. They worked with our coalition, helped get information out to us so we could get this information out more broadly. I think our relationship was so positive, and I think it encouraged them to continue working with other messengers. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about another project we're working on, the VIC Network, which is about getting immunization coalitions and immunization programs to work more closely with their public health information officers and other health communicators to expand your message as well. This is a snapshot of the Department of Public Health's website, as Kathleen was telling you. Tons of great information. Rather than having people recreate pieces, we always encourage them to get over there, look and see what's there, and if there's something that's not there, let us know, and we'll communicate that if they don't communicate with them directly to find out what's needed in their community. But generally speaking, people have found these resources here on the CDC website. This is also a snapshot of how it just went from bad to bad. And the depth, some of the depth of the coverage, you know, New York Times, Los Angeles, WebMD, CNN, et cetera, just kept going up. I know Ken could talk to you at great length about all the numbers of calls they got about this in California. And one of the great parts of our partnership is that when they were calling about issues around things like personal belief exemptions, was that part of this? Is it because you've got people opting out of immunizations? Is that part of it? Is there anything afoot to make changes in California, or if it was about this pertussis mandate, you know, is that why? It's because we're not requiring kids to get this at seventh grade, is that why? He would encourage them to, or it would let them know that there was a resource that they could contact, since it's a little more difficult for the health department, state or local public health department staff to respond to that. So he would suggest they contact me, and so I would get an opportunity to give them another side of this and get them to other resources. It's interesting how once they cover the epidemic and the deaths and where is it coming, I know there was also some, and I can't go into this in detail, so I wasn't responding to these, but I know there was a lot of things on the blogs about it's those Hispanic kids, it's those immigrant children, it's those people coming over the border. It's so, to me, personally offensive and uneducated, but I think they were getting a lot of that also at the public health, public information office. But it would also go to, is it because of the personal belief exemption? So I got quite several calls about what are we doing in California about personal belief exemptions, and is that what's causing all this? So I'd get some of those calls, and it was a great opportunity to develop relationships with the media as a coalition, so I'm appreciative of that partnership as well. This is a rock song, and we don't have the music here. You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get more than you want. And when we finally got everything through the legislature, and in September when Governor Schwarzenegger signed the bill for passing AB 354, they not only gave us the seventh grade mandate, but I think about a month before they said, no, we want everybody immunized. We want 7th through 12th graders. If that's the problem there, we want all of them immunized. So from a public health perspective, excellent. That's wonderful. But then horrifyingly, that is, I think, about 3 million kids that you have to either check or immunize. And the estimate is that there's about 1.5 million to be immunized or needs to get it as of this mandate. We call it the super mandate. And again, great for the kids, great for our community. Hopefully it's going to decrease our cases substantially, but it's causing a lot of work and concern at the at all sorts of places, the public health departments, and of course schools, and especially in light of all the funding cuts. I've been doing some roundtables with key groups in California, or statewide organizations, especially the ones that I get to work with closely in Sacramento, and we had one especially with school nurses, school health centers, the Primary Care Association, and the Medical Association, those groups, to talk about how we can work together on these efforts. And it's been really great to work with these folks, because not only have we talked about what we're already doing and not duplicating things, hopefully, and talking about what resources, what we started off with was the key challenges, and there was a long list, two-pager, but I identified some of them here. And these mainly came from the school nurses, and I wish they would have had a chance to talk to the appropriations chair and that committee that decided to create the super mandate, so they would understand how much work it was going to be, how important it was, but how much work, and maybe they should give us a little time if that's what they were going to insist upon. But some of the key challenges are listed here. Kathleen mentioned that we believe about 50% are probably immunized, 53%. The perception of the school nurses that we spoke with is that it's much lower, and possibly around 25% in some areas. You know, you just don't know. We have a good registry, but it doesn't have everybody in there, particularly not the teens. Lots of babies, lots of children, but I used to do registry work, but I'm not familiar with the numbers right now. But they this could be very well be true in some areas. They expressed concern about the providers not being fully aware of recommendations, that they may be giving TD instead, or if they're giving TDAP, they're putting it down as DTAP, that there's still a lot of confusion about that. Kathleen mentioned we've done there's several webinars that have been conducted, one for clinicians, one for school nurses, and I think a third one for clinicians also, that two of them we helped sponsor, and they were very popular and, again, archived for people to go to refresh themselves on not only how to diagnose pertussis, but, you know, what the proper immunizations are. And, again, there's tons of great resources on that CDPH website, especially about which vials to give and how to record things. One of the great ways that the provider associations and medical associations and AAP, AAFP can be of help to us is reaching, trying to get to all the members, because, you know, often you send an email out to somebody and you expect it's going to be forwarded to the other people, but many times we find that people, you send it to the CEO, you send it to the medical director, you send it to the clinic manager, and that's where it goes, because they think, I guess, you have this magic list with everybody on it, and it's going out to everybody else. So we are working together so they can encourage their folks to make sure all of their staff are getting it. And another great idea, and it may not be new to you, but I thought it was fabulous, is that, you know, I know when I was working at a county health department, and we were focusing very heavily on infant immunizations, toddler immunizations, every child by two, you know, that was we were training and teaching providers to, you know, to use every opportunity to immunize. Every time you see a kid, you know, whether they're a little bit ill or at a clinic, you know, make sure you're looking at their records to make sure they're up to date. And the provider associations mentioned that they're interested in making sure that that becomes part of their office culture now, that every adolescent, because we don't see the adolescents in the office like you do children. And so it's so important to check to see where they're at, whether it's a sports physical, they came in for a broken finger, get something sewn up, which is a little more likely sometimes among adolescents. Or for, you know, young women who are coming in for their first pap smear or whatever to get birth control, that they get in, I don't know what teens go in for nowadays, because I remember when I had teenagers, they didn't go in that often. And there's also this sort of awkward time where they're a little bit too old for the pediatrician and they're too young for the family practice physician. And so there's some concerns that the nurses have expressed, the school nurses have expressed. Again, if you're in California, you know, if you're out, you're probably maybe experiencing the same thing. Many of our districts have no school nurses. Over half of them have no school nurses, and I understand that there's going to be additional cuts to the nursing staff. And so they're up for it. We passed a hepatitis B law, 97 or 98, something like that, and they got three doses into kids and recalled kids, and so they know they can do it, they're up for it, and they're fully supportive of all this. They're completely supportive of the mandate, but it is a challenge. It's even more challenging with no money, and the school's getting cut as well as the school nurses. One of the last three here is about reviewing and interpreting immunization records, school staff training and concern, complex waiver issues because, and I won't go into detail about that, but there's it involves stickers and the blue card, and it gets very complicated, so there's some education involved in that. Oops, I got it twice. So our communication plan, what we've come up with as a coalition and we're working with our partners to do is to make sure that we have coordinated and consistent messages. And the big message is contact your doctor or healthcare provider to see if your child is up to date. A lot of people would like to do like school clinics or mass clinics or work with the pharmacies, you know, to, you know, kind of almost like an emergency situation. There's no money for that. And it's very confusing, especially because of the cost and the payment and the insurance reimbursement. It's very confusing. So what we want to do is we always want kids to go to their medical home. So it's the best thing we do is keep telling them, go to your doctor, check with your doctor, find a doctor, go to the health department. Lovely enough, though, I got a call from Kaiser, my two nieces that I care for. They're up to date, and Kaiser sent me a little robocall telling me that they were up to date. Yay, Kaiser. And I understand several other health plans are doing that in California. So if people are connected with a health plan that has that capacity, they're doing that work already, and that's wonderful. So we're encouraging folks to do that. One of the ways we're working with CDPH Immunization Branch and the Department of Education is we are going to be doing media events in about 2 or 3 weeks. As soon as I get back, we're doing that. Before school year ends, but in particular before spring break for a lot of California students, because we want to suggest, use spring break, go get that taken care of. Do whatever you can to get this done before school's out. And we don't want to scare people and remind them that these lines are endless. For parents who are very busy, they need some time out, time to plan for this. But we're thrilled to have this partnership with the Department of Education. We previously did not have that association or a close association. Once they got to know us, they made all sorts of resources and information available to us, and we're going to work together on this, and I'm just thrilled. We're working with the Department of Public Health on getting out PSAs, web banners, which I'm going to show you in a sec, all sorts of frequently asked questions, and we're going to work on some billboard projects. Like I said, we're promoting and encouraging everybody to go to the Shots for School website, where we've got CDPH's project, information on the seventh grade law, tools specifically for schools, providers, and parents, and lots of good information on there. And we've got a countdown, 2 months, 4 days, and that was as of, I think, yesterday. These are the web banners. Such an easy thing to do for people nowadays. Cheap, free, but if you get it on as many websites as possible, people see that, and then they can link the web banner back to the Shots for School website. And there's more than this. I just chose a selection here. Templates, such as this press release that you can send out locally. We send that out to people. It's so much easier if you don't have to start from scratch, and that's our big... Our strong hope is that we can give people the resources to be able to just to make it easy for them so they can get it out there. Like I said, I'm an avid tweeter. And or the coalition's audience is other professionals, social media people, large national and sometimes international groups. But I think one of those speakers, Tim Church, I think he's here, and a couple of people have mentioned, you know, it's not just what you've got going. I got 274 followers right now, which is pretty respectable. I've been doing this about a year. It's who is following you and who's retweeting your information. That other people might have thousands, and if they see something compelling, then they're going to send it out to other people, and it's going to get that information out further. And then we... link to blogs and all our friends and get that information out. Again, Australia has been having quite a time, and I have followers from Australia, and they share this information, and I share information that they've got, too. It's interesting to me. I hope to other people as well. There's a significant group of people that are trying to push back strongly on the anti-vax community, one of the things we like to encourage among our members is to be a little bit more bold online, not inappropriate, but bold. And if you're tweeting on behalf of your health department, you have to be more structured. But if you're a coalition or another professional association, hopefully you'll have a little more leeway. Like I said, no bad words. Nothing inappropriate, but you can be a little more bold. As I think was mentioned earlier, is be conversational and be yourself, be honest. I wanted to share with you a little bit. I think I've missed a bunch of stuff, but it'll come to me as we're talking. I'm involved with the National Public Health Information Coalition, which is a network of public health information officers and other communicators. And we've created a VIC network, Virtual Immunization Communication Network, and we've held webinars. I hope you've been able to attend some of those. And we are doing an online symposium May 25th, so I didn't want to lose the opportunity to pitch this. And my biggest message in all of this and reason for bringing this up is that this project is a way to help connect, again, health communicators, public health information officers, public affairs folks with the health departments, with the coalitions, so they can help expand your message. I think we've been able to successfully realize that in California quite a bit. I love working, again, Ken August, who's one of the longtime members of NIFIC, and he and his staff and his other folks at their office, I knew Ken a little bit before, but now I know a lot of their staff because they've been, it seems like, much more, well, first of all, we had H1N1, now we've got this pertussis epidemic, but the media is engaged, the media wants to know, and they've been more involved and more interested, and I'm really pleased and proud to be able to work with them. One last thing I want to say, I feel like, and I'd be interested to hear what you say, the sense I've gotten from the few media people that I've interacted with over the last year or so around this issue, that they are, it's not so much, they're not looking for that balance, he said, she said. There's two sides to this. I feel like once we have that chance to help them understand what this is all about, I feel like we're getting a lot more positive messages and positive reporting out there, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that also. So I hope that's helpful, and I appreciate your time.
I'll leave your advertisement up here for the remainder. So I think this has been some really exciting presentations, and I know a lot of states, probably almost every state, has been responding to some sort of a pertussis outbreak, from what I gather, whether it was small or large. I'd love to hear from anybody else in the audience if you have any nuggets of information about how you've been communicating about this, if you've had any success or hurdles that you're trying to handle with helping to pass mandates. I don't know if anybody, you know, it's late in the day, but I think it'd be great to share. It's a good opportunity for that forum. And then in the meantime, I'd like to ask Kathleen and Catherine, you know, what's like your one major lesson learned so far? I know it's still ongoing, but probably the most important thing you've learned in responding to this. And maybe Ken can chime in too, since he's hiding in the back.
Well, that's a hard question, but I mean, I think one of the biggest things is that H1N1 really paved the way for us to be able to respond effectively to this. I mean, we already had a lot of those relationships established. We had worked well with our Office of Public Affairs for H1N1. We had to. And so having that done, everybody knew how to get into the mode, and we just kind of got right back into it to do it again. So that was really the biggest thing. And you know, the goal is not to lose that moving forward. And hopefully we won't have something big in the next year, although we used to say, oh, H1N1 so last year. Now we already feel that about pertussis. So we are a little mentally ready for something new, but we don't want another outbreak. So, but I think that that's important, is remembering that you need to maintain those relationships.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing for me. What's nice about, again, working with coalitions is that if they're not 100% connected to a health department, what's nice is that, you know, because the health department might be, you know, I just know over the years it's been smallpox, it's been anthrax, it's the big flu shortage, then it's the H1N1, then it's the pertussis, it's always something. But coalitions can keep the message going on other things while health department's doing that, so that's one of the nice things about working with the coalitions. And that leads me to one of my sort of regrets or my lessons learned is working with the legislature, that I didn't have more time to keep up with everything. I don't know if anybody else has worked on legislation or advocacy things, but to keep up with everything while you're trying to do all these other things, and that's trying to balance everything out. And keep them informed.
Presentations. My question is actually for Kathleen and only sort of related. Have you run across any issues with either local health departments or physicians' offices or hospitals going off-label with the Tdap? I know for rabies vaccine, when ACIP came out with the recommendations to switch from a 5-dose to a 4-dose, we had some pushback, and some local health departments still won't go off-label for that. I didn't know if you had that issue with Tdap.
Luckily, our health departments were on board and actually very much welcomed the recommendations. We had, before we could formalize them, we had a lot of local health departments saying, if you can't do it, we'll do it here. So they were on board. We communicated with them all along. There were lots of issues with reimbursement that came up at local health departments, or at facilities, not at the local health departments. But so that came up with the 7 to 9-year-olds and then the over 64. And it shouldn't have been an issue, but was, and we're still working to address that and trying to work with some of the big payers to make sure that Tdap will be covered.
Hi there. First of all, I just want to say nice job. I mean, you guys know those are intense situations to be involved with, long hours, high stress. You developed some really good materials that I think folks could use far and beyond the state of California, so nice job with that. I have two communications-related questions. One is around the term cocooning. Somebody brought it up, and I've heard it used as well, but I wonder, is that a term you folks decided was one you could use publicly? Were you using it with the general public, and if so, was there some education that had to was involved with that, or is that a term you only use internally? And then if you can tell me a little bit more about the ethnic media roundtables and just how you went about them and if you felt they were valuable in the time you spent.
Yep. I'm happy to address. So, So I kind of think we'll address this as well. But we certainly did education around cocooning. We couldn't just put the word out there and have people know what that meant. But it also was something that I do think the public latched onto. And, you know, it's a great concept, and people like it, and they really get that you're really protecting this young infant. So I think visually it works. But we needed to educate people on what that was. And then I forget already what your second question was. We have a participant who is at one of the ethnic media roundtables.
Yeah, our experience with the ethnic media roundtables was, well, it began a number of years ago when we started doing them around emergency preparedness activities. And what they are essentially a news briefing for different members of the ethnic news media. We worked with a third party called New America Media, which, if you're not familiar with them, you can Google them and find them. And they are a nationwide organization representing all the various ethnic news media, and they find them large and small. We at the department think we have a pretty good media list, but they're just tremendous. And it's a much more informal kind of discussion than you have at a typical news briefing. And we use the briefings not only to share information about a particular health issue, as in this case pertussis, but also to solicit information to say, tell us how this topic is resonating in your community. And if you'll allow me, I'll go back to a story from long ago when there were a lot of concerns around bird flu. We held ethnic media roundtables around bird flu, and we heard from something that hadn't occurred to us, and that was that members of the Asian American press were saying, stop saying avian flu. And we said, well, what's the problem with avian flu? And they said, well, because to newcomers to California, the term sounds like Asian flu. And for some, they think it's a flu either just targeting Asians or just communicated by Asians. So that's when we said, well, okay, well, great, we're going to just use bird flu. So with the pertussis roundtables, we held three. And to give credit where credit is due, it was with the support of the CDC that we held our first two in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Very well attended, got very good media coverage out of it, and really raised awareness among the ethnic news media about this issue, and helped to establish some relationships that weren't there before. So.
Just a quick, simple question, I guess. Do you recommend the continued use, Kathleen, of pertussis and whooping cough when you're preparing printed materials to the public? Do you think it's still necessary to have whooping cough? We've been debating this back at home, you know. So in your experience in California, in order to capture everybody, you have to still use both terms.
So using whooping cough and pertussis?
Both,
your question.
Right.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Do you have a comment on that?
It's still necessary.
Yeah. It feels like it.
Yeah. We're sick of it. But
yeah. No, it's necessary. The problem is you can't use just one because people don't know what's in the vaccine if you say whooping cough. They know about DTP, and so I think that's the hard part. So you really do have to have both.
Thank you.
And like when we wrote letters to legislators or wrote down out things, you know, we found that they're going to get it. Some people are calling it only whooping cough, and some people are only calling it pertussis. So they had to know which one, know that they were connected.
Hi, just a scheduling question. Since you're giving the kids between 7 and 10 the Tdap at times, okay, when they haven't had pertussis coverage before, when do they get the next one? They don't get a next one.
Well, so for 7 to 9-year-olds was only for those that were under-immunized.
Right.
So with that population, if you had somebody that had missed a dose, they would go ahead and fall under the next booster recommendation at 11.
At 11.
But a 10-year-old... is set until we hear otherwise from ACIP about a revaccination recommendation.
Okay, thanks.
Is that clear?
Jen, anything else to add?
Well, yeah. So I'm Jennifer, and I'm the
I work with the pertussis vaccines ACIP working group. The issue of revaccination with Tdap is one of the things that the working group is going to be addressing in the near future. So, and then we'll be presenting that to ACIP. So at this time, there's nothing to comment, but it's something that is on the table to be discussed.
Will the vaccine recommendations for pregnant women be revisited? Or is that going to be a continuing recommendation for California?
For California, we'll continue the recommendation. And it's very open. I mean, it's vaccinate women of childbearing age whenever you get them, whether it's pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy, or after pregnancy. So some clinicians are certainly not comfortable vaccinating in pregnancy, and many are quite comfortable. And the data are a bit conflicting on what the immunogenicity will be in the infant when it's their turn to get vaccinated. So I do think ACIP will be addressing that issue, and we will probably not change what we've recommended until we hear from ACIP. But that's all I know at this point. And I did want to make one other comment. Catherine had mentioned that in the midst of the outbreak, we had a lot of communications around, negative communications that came in from people around, you know, is this a Hispanic thing? Is this coming from Mexico? Are these illegal immigrants bringing this disease? And it was helpful. We had done a study a couple of years ago looking at infants that were infected and what their risk factors of infection were. And we were able to, in that study, show that country of origin of the mother had no impact on whether or not the baby was more likely to be infected. So we could say that this was not an issue that was from foreign-born families bringing this in, and it was easy to show real data to fight those types of rumors. So that was helpful to have some of that background. I don't know if any of the other states that maybe are on the border have been dealing with that issue, but it certainly is something that still hasn't quite gone away.
Only the border of California.
That's right.
If no one has any other questions, I will read our housekeeping announcements. But before I do that, I wanted to do two quick shout-outs. One, if you haven't seen CDC's Pertussis website, there are a lot of great resources on it. There's e-cards and podcasts, and there's free 5-minute Medscape videos that CDC has a partnership with Medscape now that you can get to. From there, it's just cdc.gov/pertussis. And I also want to give a shout-out to the CDC Pertussis team, many of whom are here today. Raise your hand. We've got quite a few. they've been...